of formal conferences or rules or even basic principles of organization. Rather, the Thai club was loosely clustered around informal conversations. Meetings happened by chance or not at all. Letters proposing madcap unpublished ideas, often accompanied by hand-scribbled figures, were circulated among the members. It was a blog before blogs. Watson got a tailor in Los Angeles to embroider green woolen ties with a golden strand of RNA, and Gamow sent a tie and a pin to each in the group of friends that he had handpicked as club members. He printed a letterhead and added his own motto, "Do or die, or don't try." In the mid-1950s, a pair of bacterial geneticists working in Paris, Jacques Monod and François Jacob, had also performed experiments that had dimly suggested that an intermediate molecule, a messenger, was required for the translation of DNA into proteins. Genes, they proposed, did not specify instructions for proteins directly. Rather, genetic information in DNA was first converted into a soft copy, a draft form, and it was this copy, not the DNA original, that was translated into a protein. In April 1960, Francis Crick and Jacob met at Sidney Brenner's cramped apartment in Cambridge to discuss the identity of this mysterious intermediate. The son of a cobbler from South Africa, Brenner had come to England to study biology on a scholarship. Like Watson and Crick, he too had become entranced by Watson's religion of genes and DNA. Over a barely digested lunch, the three scientists realized that this intermediate molecule had to shuttle from the cell's nucleus, where genes were stored, to the cytoplasm, where proteins were synthesized. But what was the chemical identity of the message that was built from a gene? Was it a protein or a nucleic acid or some other kind of molecule? What was its relationship to the sequence of the gene? Although they still lacked concrete evidence, Brenner and Crick also suspected that it was RNA, DNA's molecular cousin. In 1959, Crick wrote a poem to the Thai Club, although he never sent it out. What are the properties of genetic RNA? Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? That damned elusive Pimpernel. In the early spring of 1960, Jacob flew to Caltech to work with Matthew Meselson to trap the damned elusive Pimpernel. Brenner arrived in early June, a few weeks later. Proteins, Brenner and Jacob knew, are synthesized within a cell by a specialized cellular component called the ribosome. The surest means to purify the messenger intermediate was to halt protein synthesis abruptly, using a biochemical equivalent of a cold shower, and purify the shivering molecules associated with the ribosomes, thereby trapping the elusive Pimpernel. The principle seemed obvious, but the actual experiment proved mysteriously daunting. At first, Brenner reported, all he could see in the experiment was the chemical equivalent of thick California fog, wet, cold, silent. The fussy biochemical setup had taken weeks to perfect, except each time the ribosomes were caught, they crumbled and fell apart. Inside cells, ribosomes seemed to stay glued together with absolute equanimity. Why then did they degenerate outside cells, like fog slipping through fingers? The answer appeared out of the fog, literally. Brenner and Jacob were sitting on the beach one morning when Brenner, ruminating on his basic biochemistry lessons, realized a profoundly simple fact. Their solutions must be missing an essential chemical factor that kept ribosomes intact within cells. But what factor? It had to be something small, common, and ubiquitous. A tiny dab of molecular glue. He shot up from the sand, his hair flying, sand dribbling from his pockets, screaming, "It's the magnesium! It's the magnesium!" It was the magnesium. The addition of the ion was critical. With the solution supplemented with magnesium, the ribosome remained glued together, and Brenner and Jacob finally purified a minuscule amount of the messenger molecule out of bacterial cells. It was RNA, as expected, but RNA of a special kind. The messenger was generated afresh when a gene was translated. Like DNA, these RNA molecules were built by stringing together four bases, A, G, C, and U, in the RNA copy of a gene. Remember, the T found in DNA is substituted for U. Notably, Brenner and Jacob later discovered the messenger RNA was a facsimile of the DNA chain, a copy made from the original. The RNA copy of a gene then moved from the nucleus to the cytosol, where its message was decoded to build a protein. The messenger RNA was neither an inhabitant of heaven nor of hell, but a professional go-between. The generation of an RNA copy of a gene was termed transcription, referring to the rewriting of a word or sentence in a language close to the original. A gene's code, ATGGGCC, was transcribed into an RNA code, AUGGGCC. The process was akin to a library of rare books that is accessed for translation. The master copy of information, i.e., the gene, was stored permanently in a deep repository or vault. When a translation request was generated by a cell, a photocopy of the original was summoned from the vault of the nucleus. This facsimile of a gene, i.e., RNA, was used as a working source for translation into a protein. The process allowed multiple copies of a gene to be in circulation at the same time, and for the RNA copies to be increased or decreased on demand, facts that would soon prove to be crucial to the understanding of a gene's activity and function. But transcription solved only half the problem of protein synthesis. The other half remained. How was the RNA message decoded into a protein? To make an RNA copy of a gene, the cell used a rather simple transposition. Every A, C, T, and G in a gene was copied to an A, C, U, and G in the messenger RNA, i.e., A, C, T, C, C, T, G, G, G becomes A, C, U, C, C, U, G, G, G. The only difference in code between the gene's original and the RNA copy was the substitution of the thymine to a uracil, T to U. But once transposed into RNA, how was a gene's message decoded into a protein? To Watson and Crick, it was immediately clear that no single base, A, C, T, or G, could carry sufficient genetic message to build any part of a protein. There are 20 amino acids in all, and four letters could not specify 20 alternative states by themselves. The secret had to be in the combination of bases. It seems likely, they wrote, that the precise sequence of the bases is the code that carries the genetical information. An analogy to natural language illustrates the point. The letters A, C, and T convey very little meaning by themselves, but can be combined in ways to produce substantially different messages. It is, once again, the sequence that carries the message. The words act, tack, and cat, for instance, arise from the same letters, yet signal vastly different meanings. The key to solving the actual genetic code was to map the elements of a sequence in an RNA chain to the sequence of a protein chain. It was like deciphering the Rosetta Stone of genetics. Which combination of letters in RNA specified which combination of letters in a protein? Through a series of ingenious experiments, Crick and Brenner realized that the genetic code had to occur in a triplet form, i.e. three bases of DNA, for example, ACT, had to specify one amino acid in a protein. But which triplet specified which amino acid? By 1961, several laboratories around the world had joined the race to decipher the genetic code. At the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Marshall Nirenberg, Heinrich Mattai, and Philip Leder used a biochemical approach to try to crack the cipher. An Indian-born chemist, Har Karana, supplied crucial chemical reagents that made code-breaking possible. And a Spanish biochemist in New York, Severo Ochoa, launched a parallel effort to map the triplet code to corresponding amino acids. As with all code-breaking, the work proceeded misstep by misstep. At first, one triplet seemed to overlap with another, making the prospect of a simple code impossible. Then, for a while, it seemed that some triplets did not work at all. But by 1965, all of these studies had successfully mapped every DNA triplet to a corresponding amino acid. ACT, for instance, specified the amino acid threonine. CAT, in contrast, specified a different amino acid, histidine. CGT specified arginine. A particular sequence of DNA, ACT, GAC, CAC, GTG, was therefore used to build an RNA chain, and the RNA chain was translated into a chain of amino acids, ultimately leading to the construction of a protein. One triplet, ATG, was the code to start the building of a protein, and three triplets, TAA, TAG, TGA, represented codes to stop it. The basic alphabet of the genetic code was complete. The flow of information could be stated simply, DNA to RNA to protein, or at a conceptual level, gene to message to function. Francis Crick called this flow of information the central dogma of biological information. The word dogma was an odd choice. Crick later admitted that he never understood the linguistic implications of dogma, which implies a fixed, immutable belief, but the central was an accurate description. Crick was referring to the striking universality of the flow of genetic information throughout biology. From bacteria to elephants, from red-eyed flies to blue-blooded princes, biological information flowed through living systems in a systematic, archetypal manner. DNA provided instructions to build RNA. RNA provided instructions to build proteins. Proteins ultimately enabled structure and function, bringing genes to life. Perhaps no illness illustrates the nature of this information flow and its penetrating effects on human physiology as powerfully as sickle cell anemia. As early as the 6th century BC, Ayurvedic practitioners in India had recognized the general symptoms of anemia, the absence of adequate red cells in blood, by the characteristic pallor of the lips, skin, and fingers. Termed Pandu Roga in Sanskrit, anemias were further subdivided into categories. Some variants of the illness were known to be caused by nutritional deficiencies. Others were thought to be precipitated by episodes of blood loss. But sickle cell anemia must have seemed the strangest, for it was hereditary, often appeared in fits and starts, and was accompanied by sudden wrenching bouts of pain in the bones, joints, and chest. The God tribe in West Africa called the pain chui chui chui, body beating. The Ewe named it nui dui dui, body twisting. Onomatopoeic words, whose very sound seemed to capture the relentless nature of a pain, that felt like corkscrews driven into the marrow. In 1904, a single image captured under a microscope provided a unifying cause for all these seemingly disparate symptoms. That year, a young dentistry student named Walter Knoll presented to his doctor in Chicago with an acute anemic crisis, accompanied by the characteristic chest and bone pain. Knoll was from the Caribbean, of West African descent, and had suffered several such episodes over the prior years. Having ruled out a heart attack, the cardiologist, James Herrick, assigned the case rather casually to a medical resident named Ernest Irons. Acting on a whim, Irons decided to look at Knoll's blood under the microscope. Irons found a bewildering alteration. Normal red blood cells are shaped like flattened discs, a shape that allows them to be stacked atop each other, and thus move smoothly through networks of arteries and capillaries and veins, bringing oxygen to the liver, heart, and brain. In Knoll's blood, the cells had morphed mysteriously into shriveled scythe-shaped crescents, sickle cells, as Irons later described them. But what made a red blood cell acquire a sickle shape? And why was the illness hereditary? The natural culprit was an abnormality in the gene for hemoglobin, the protein that carries oxygen and is present abundantly in red cells. In 1951, working with Harvey Itano at Caltech, Linus Pauling demonstrated that the variant of hemoglobin found in sickle cells was different from the hemoglobin in normal cells. 5 years later, scientists in Cambridge pinpointed the difference between the protein chain of normal hemoglobin and sickled hemoglobin to a change in a single amino acid. But if the protein chain was altered by exactly one amino acid, then its gene had to be different by precisely one triplet. One triplet encodes one amino acid. Indeed, as predicted, when the gene encoding the hemoglobin B chain was later identified and sequenced in sickle cell patients, there was a single change. One triplet in DNA, GAG, had changed to another, GTG. This resulted in the substitution of one amino acid for another. Glutamate was switched to valine. That switch altered the folding of the hemoglobin chain. Rather than twisting into its neatly articulated clasp-like structure, the mutant hemoglobin protein accumulated in string-like clumps within red cells. These clumps grew so large, particularly in the absence of oxygen, that they tugged the membrane of the red cell until the normal disc was warped into a crescent-shaped, dysmorphic sickle cell. Unable to glide smoothly through capillaries and veins, sickled red cells jammed into microscopic clots throughout the body, interrupting blood flow and precipitating the excruciating pain of a sickling crisis. It was a Rube Goldberg disease. A change in the sequence of a gene caused the change in the sequence of a protein. That warped its shape. That shrank a cell. That clogged a vein. That jammed the flow. That racked the body that genes built. Gene, protein, function, and fate were strung in a chain. One chemical alteration in one base pair in DNA was sufficient to encode a radical change in human fate. Regulation, replication, recombination. It is absolutely necessary to find the origin of this pain in the ass. Jacques Monod. Just as the formulation of a giant crystal can be seeded by the formal arrangement of a few critical atoms at its core, the birth of a great body of science can be nucleated by the interlocking of a few crucial concepts. Before Newton, generations of physicists had thought about phenomena such as force, acceleration, mass, and velocity. But Newton's genius involved defining these terms rigorously and linking them to each other via a nest of equations, thereby launching the science of mechanics. By similar logic, the interlocking of just a few crucial concepts, a gene encodes a message to build a protein, relaunched the science of genetics. In time, as with Newtonian mechanics, the central dogma of genetics would be vastly refined, modified, and reformulated. But its effect on the nascent science was profound. It locked a system of thinking into place. In 1909, Johansson, coining the word gene, had declared it free of any hypothesis. By the early 1960s, however, the gene had vastly exceeded a hypothesis. Genetics had found a means to describe the flow of information from organism to organism, and, within an organism, from encryption to form. A mechanism of heredity had emerged. But how did this flow of biological information achieve the observed complexity of living systems? Take sickle cell anemia as a case in point. Walter Noel had inherited two abnormal copies of the hemoglobin B gene. Every cell in his body carried the two abnormal copies. Every cell in the body inherits the same genome, but only red blood cells were affected by the altered genes, not Noel's neurons or kidneys or liver cells or muscle cells. What enabled the selective action of hemoglobin in red blood cells? Why was there no hemoglobin in his eye or his skin, even though eye cells and skin cells, and indeed every cell in the human body, possessed identical copies of the same gene? How, as Thomas Morgan had put it, did the properties implicit in genes become explicit in different cells? In 1940, an experiment on the simplest of organisms, a microscopic capsule-shaped gut-dwelling bacterium named Escherichia coli, provided the first crucial clue to this question. E. coli can survive by feeding on two very different kinds of sugars, glucose and lactose. Grown on either sugar alone, the bacterium begins to divide rapidly, doubling in number every 20 minutes or so. The curve of growth can be plotted as an exponential line, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16-fold growth, until the culture turns turbid and the sugar source has been exhausted. The relentless ogive of growth fascinated Jacques Monod, the French biologist. Monod had returned to Paris in 1937, having spent a year studying flies with Thomas Morgan at Caltech. Monod's visit to California had not been particularly fruitful. He had spent most of his time playing Bach with the local orchestra and learning Dixie and jazz. But Paris was utterly depressing, a city under siege. By the summer of 1940, Belgium and Poland had fallen to the Germans. In June 1940, France, having suffered devastating losses in battle, signed an armistice that allowed the German army to occupy much of northern and western France. Paris was declared an open city, spared from bombs and ruin, but fully accessible to Nazi troops. The children were evacuated, the museums emptied of paintings, the storefront shuttered. "Paris will always be Paris," Maurice Chevalier sang, if pleadingly, in 1939, but the City of Lights was rarely illuminated. The streets were ghostly. The cafes were empty. At night, regular blackouts plunged it into an infernally bleak darkness. In the fall of 1940, with red and black flags bearing swastikas hoisted on all government buildings, and German troops announcing nightly curfews on loudspeakers along the Champs-Élysées, Monod was working on E. coli in an overheated, underlit attic of the Sorbonne. He would secretly join the French resistance that year, although many of his colleagues would never know his political proclivities. That winter, with his lab now nearly frozen by the chill, he had to wait penitently until noon, listening to Nazi propaganda on the streets while waiting for some of the acetic acid to thaw. Monod repeated the bacterial growth experiment, but with a strategic twist. This time he added both glucose and lactose, two different sugars, to the culture. If sugar was sugar was sugar, if the metabolism of lactose was no different from that of glucose, then one might have expected bacteria fed on the glucose-lactose mix to exhibit the same smooth arc of growth. But Monod stumbled on a kink in his results, literally so. The bacteria grew exponentially at first, as expected, but then paused for a while before resuming growth again. When Monod investigated this pause, he discovered an unusual phenomenon. Rather than consuming both sugars equally, the E. coli cells had selectively consumed glucose first. Then the bacterial cells had stopped growing, as if reconsidering their diet, switched to lactose, and resumed growth again. Monod called this deoxy, double growth. That bend in the growth curve, small though it was, perplexed Monod. It bothered him like a sand grain in the eye of his scientific instinct. Bacteria feeding on sugar should grow in smooth arcs. Why would a switch in sugar consumption cause a pause in growth? How might a bacterium even know, or sense, that the sugar source had been switched? And why was one sugar consumed first, and only then the second, like a two-course bistro lunch? By the late 1940s, Monod had discovered that the kink was the result of a metabolic readjustment. When bacteria switched from glucose to lactose consumption, they induced specific lactose-digesting enzymes. When they switched back to glucose, these enzymes disappeared, and glucose-digesting enzymes reappeared. The induction of these enzymes during the switch, like changing cutlery between dinner courses, remove the fish knife, set the dessert fork, took a few minutes, thereby resulting in the observed pause in growth. To Monod, deoxy suggested that genes could be regulated by metabolic inputs. If enzymes, i.e. proteins, were being induced to appear and disappear in a cell, then genes must be being turned on and off, like molecular switches. Enzymes, after all, are encoded by genes. In the early 1950s, Monod, joined by François Jacob in Paris, began to systematically explore the regulation of genes by E. coli by making mutants, the method used with such spectacular success by Morgan with fruit flies. As with flies, the bacterial mutants proved revealing. Monod and Jacob, working with Arthur Pardee, a microbial geneticist from America, discovered three cardinal principles that governed the regulation of genes. First, when a gene was turned on or off, the DNA master copy was always kept intact in a cell. The real action was in RNA. When a gene was turned on, it was induced to make more RNA messages and thereby produce more sugar-digesting enzymes. A cell's metabolic identity, i.e. whether it was consuming lactose or glucose, could be ascertained not by the sequence of its genes, which was always constant, but by the amount of RNA that a gene was producing. During lactose metabolism, the RNAs for lactose-digesting enzymes were abundant. During glucose metabolism, those messages were repressed, and the RNAs for glucose-digesting enzymes became abundant. Second, the production of RNA messages was coordinately regulated. When the sugar source was switched to lactose, the bacteria turned on an entire module of genes, several lactose-metabolizing genes, to digest lactose. One of the genes in the module specified a transporter protein that allowed lactose to enter the bacterial cell. Another gene encoded an enzyme that was needed to break down lactose into parts. Yet another specified an enzyme to break those chemical parts into subparts. Surprisingly, all the genes dedicated to a particular metabolic pathway were physically present next to each other on the bacterial chromosome.
like library books stacked by subject, and they were induced simultaneously in cells. The metabolic alteration produced a profound genetic alteration in a cell. It wasn't just a cutlery switch. The whole dinner service was altered in a single swoop. A functional circuit of genes was switched on and off, as if operated by a common pool or a master switch. Minot called one such gene module an operon. The genesis of proteins was thus perfectly synchronized with the requirements of the environment. Supply the correct sugar, and a set of sugar-metabolizing genes would be turned on together. The terrifying economy of evolution had again produced the most elegant solution to gene regulation. No gene, no message, and no protein labored in vain. How did a lactose-sensing protein recognize and regulate only a lactose-digesting gene, and not the thousands of other genes in a cell? The third cardinal feature of gene regulation, Minot and Jacob discovered, was that every gene had specific regulatory DNA sequences appended to it that acted like recognition tags. Once a sugar-sensing protein had detected sugar in the environment, it would recognize one such tag and turn the target genes on or off. That was a gene signal to make more RNA messages and thereby generate the relevant enzyme to digest the sugar. A gene, in short, possessed not just information to encode a protein, but also information about when and where to make that protein. All that data was encrypted in DNA, typically appended to the front of every gene, although regulatory sequences can also be appended to the ends and middles of genes. The combination of regulatory sequences and the protein encoding sequence defined a gene. Once again, we might return to our analogy to an English sentence. When Morgan had discovered gene linkage in 1910, he had found no seeming logic to why one gene was physically strung with another on a chromosome. The sable-colored and the white-eyed genes seemed to have no common functional connection, yet sat, cheek by jowl, on the same chromosome. In Jacob and Minot's model, in contrast, bacterial genes were strung together for a reason. Genes that operated on the same metabolic pathway were physically linked to each other. If you work together, then you live together in the genome. Specific sequences of DNA were appended to a gene that provided context for its activity, its work. These sequences, meant to turn genes on and off, might be likened to punctuation marks in annotations, inverted quotes, a comma, a capitalized letter in a sentence. They provide context, emphasis, and meaning, informing a reader what parts are to be read together and when to pause for the next sentence. This is the structure of your genome. It contains, among other things, independently regulated modules. Some words are gathered into sentences. Others are separated by semicolons, commas, and dashes. Pardy, Jacob, and Minot published their monumental study on the lactose operon in 1959, 6 years after the Watson and Crick paper on the structure of DNA, called the Pajamo, or colloquially the Pajama paper, after the initials of the three authors. The study was instantly a classic, with vast implications for biology. Genes, the Pajama paper argued, were not just passive blueprints. Even though every cell contains the same set of genes, an identical genome, the selective activation or repression of particular subsets of genes allows an individual cell to respond to its environments. The genome was an active blueprint, capable of deploying selected parts of its code at different times and in different circumstances. Proteins act as regulatory sensors or master switches in this process, turning on and turning off genes, or even combinations of genes in a coordinate manner. Like the master score of a bewitchingly complex symphonic work, the genome contains the instructions for the development and maintenance of organisms. But the genomic score is inert without proteins. Proteins actualize this information. They conduct the genome, thereby playing out its music, activating the viola at the 14th minute, a crash of cymbals during the arpeggio, a roll of drums at the crescendo. Or, conceptually, a gene encodes a message to build a protein that regulates a gene, which encodes a message, and so forth. The Pajamo paper laid a central question of genetics to bed. How can an organism have a fixed set of genes, yet respond so acutely to changes in the environment? But it also suggested a solution to the central question in embryogenesis, How can thousands of cell types arise from an embryo out of the same set of genes? The regulation of genes, the selective turning on and off of certain genes in certain cells and at certain times, must interpose a crucial layer of complexity on the unblinking nature of biological information. It was through gene regulation, Minot argued, that cells could achieve their unique functions in time and space. The genome contains not only a series of blueprints, i.e. genes, but a coordinated program and a means of controlling its execution, Minot and Jacob concluded. Walter Knowles' red blood cells and liver cells contain the same genetic information, but gene regulation ensured that the hemoglobin protein was only present in red blood cells and not in the liver. The caterpillar and the butterfly carry precisely the same genome, but gene regulation enables the metamorphosis of one into the other. Embryogenesis could be reimagined as the gradual unfurling of gene regulation from a single-celled embryo. This was the movement that Aristotle had so vividly imagined centuries before. In a famous story, a medieval cosmologist is asked what holds the earth up. "Turtles," he says. "And what holds up the turtles?" he is asked. "More turtles." "And those turtles?" "You don't understand," the cosmologist stamps his foot. "It's turtles all the way." To a geneticist, the development of an organism could be described as the sequential induction or repression of genes in genetic circuits. Genes specified proteins that switched on genes that specified proteins that switched on genes, and so forth, all the way to the very first embryological cell. It was genes all the way. Gene regulation, the turning on and off of genes by proteins, described the mechanism by which combinatorial complexity could be generated from the one hard copy of genetic information in a cell. But it could not explain the copying of genes themselves. How are genes replicated when a cell divides into two cells, or when a sperm or egg is generated? To Watson and Crick, the double helix model of DNA with two complementary yin-yang strands counterposed against each other instantly suggested a mechanism for replication. In the last sentence of the 1953 paper, they noted, "It has not escaped our notice that the specific pairing of DNA we have postulated immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism for the genetic material." Their model of DNA was not just a pretty picture. The structure predicted the most important features of the function. Watson and Crick proposed that each DNA strand was used to generate a copy of itself, thereby generating two double helices from the original double helix. During replication, the yin-yang strands of DNA were peeled apart. The yin was used as a template to create a yang, and the yang to make a yin, and this resulted in two yin-yang pairs. But a DNA double helix cannot autonomously make a copy of itself. Otherwise, it might replicate without self-control. An enzyme was likely dedicated to copying DNA, a replicator protein. In 1957, the biochemist Arthur Kornberg set out to isolate the DNA copying enzyme. If such an enzyme existed, Kornberg reasoned, the easiest place to find it would be in an organism that was dividing rapidly, E. coli, during its furious phase of growth. By 1958, Kornberg had distilled and redistilled the bacterial sludge into a nearly pure enzyme preparation. "A geneticist counts, a biochemist cleans," he once told me. He called it DNA polymerase. DNA is a polymer of A, C, G, and T, and this was the polymer-making enzyme. When he added the purified enzyme to DNA, supplied a source of energy and a reservoir of fresh nucleotide bases, A, T, G, and C, he could witness the formation of new strands of nucleic acid in a test tube. DNA made DNA in its own image. 5 years ago, Kornberg wrote in 1960, the synthesis of DNA was also regarded as a vital process, a mystical reaction that could not be reproduced in a test tube by the addition or subtraction of mere chemicals. Tampering with the very genetic apparatus of life itself, this theory ran, would surely produce nothing but disorder. But Kornberg's synthesis of DNA had created order out of disorder, a gene out of its chemical subunits. The unassailability of genes was no longer a barrier. There is a recursion here that is worth noting. Like all proteins, DNA polymerase, the enzyme that enables DNA to replicate, is itself the product of a gene. Built into every genome, then, are the codes for proteins that will allow the genome to reproduce. This additional layer of complexity, that DNA encodes a protein that allows DNA to replicate, is important because it provides a critical node for regulation. DNA replication can be turned on and turned off by other signals and regulators, such as the age or the nutritional status of a cell, thus allowing cells to make DNA copies only when they are ready to divide. This scheme has a collateral rub. When the regulators themselves go rogue, nothing can stop a cell from replicating continuously. That, as we will soon learn, is the ultimate disease of malfunctioning genes, cancer. Genes make proteins that regulate genes. Genes make proteins that replicate genes. The third R of the physiology of genes is a word that lies outside common human vocabulary, but is essential to the survival of our species. Recombination. The ability to generate new combinations of genes. To understand recombination, we might yet again begin with Mendel and Darwin. A century of exploration of genetics illuminated how organisms transmit likeness to each other. Units of hereditary information encoded in DNA and packaged on chromosomes are transmitted through sperm and egg into an embryo, and from the embryo to every living cell in an organism's body. These units encode messages to build proteins, and the messages and proteins in turn enable the form and function of a living organism. But while this description of the mechanism of heredity solved Mendel's question, how does like beget like, it failed to solve Darwin's converse riddle, how does like beget unlike. For evolution to occur, an organism must be able to generate genetic variation, i.e. it must produce descendants that are genetically different from either parent. If genes typically transmit likeness, then how can they transmit unlikeness? One mechanism of generating variation in nature is mutation, i.e. alterations in the sequence of DNA, an A switched to a T, that may change the structure of a protein and thereby alter its function. Mutations occur when DNA is damaged by chemicals or X-rays, or when the DNA replication enzyme makes a spontaneous error in copying genes. But a second mechanism of generating genetic diversity exists. Genetic information can be swapped between chromosomes. DNA from the maternal chromosome can exchange positions with DNA from the paternal chromosome, potentially generating a gene hybrid of maternal and paternal genes. Recombination is also a form of mutation, except whole chunks of genetic material are swapped between chromosomes. The movement of genetic information from one chromosome to another occurs only under extremely special circumstances. The first occurs when sperm and eggs are generated for reproduction. Just before the spermiogenesis and oogenesis, the cell turns briefly into a playpen for genes. The paired maternal and paternal chromosomes hug each other and readily swap genetic information. The swapping of genetic information between paired chromosomes is crucial to the mixing and matching of hereditary information between parents. Morgan called this phenomenon crossing over. His students had used crossing over to map genes in flies. The more contemporary term is recombination, the ability to generate combinations of genes. The second circumstance is more portentous. When DNA is damaged by a mutagen, such as X-rays, genetic information is obviously threatened. When such damage occurs, the gene can be recopied from the twin copy on the paired chromosome. Part of the maternal copy may be redrafted from the paternal copy, again resulting in the creation of hybrid genes. Once again, the pairing of bases is used to build the gene back. The yin fixes the yang. The image restores the original. With DNA, as with Dorian Gray, the prototype is constantly reinvigorated by its portrait. Proteins chaperone and coordinate the entire process, guiding the damaged strand to the intact gene, copying and correcting the lost information, and stitching the breaks together, ultimately resulting in the transfer of information from the undamaged strand to the damaged strand. Regulation, replication, recombination. Remarkably, the three R's of gene physiology are acutely dependent on the molecular structure of DNA, on the Watson-Crick base pairing of the double helix. Gene regulation works through the transcription of DNA into RNA, which depends on base pairing. When a strand of DNA is used to build the RNA message, it is the pairing of bases between DNA and RNA that allows a gene to generate its RNA copy. During replication, DNA is, once again, copied using its image as a guide. Each strand is used to generate a complementary version of itself, resulting in one double helix that splits into two double helices. And during the recombination of DNA, the strategy of interposing base against base is deployed yet again to restore damaged DNA. The damaged copy of a gene is reconstructed using the complementary strand, or the second copy of the gene, as its guide. The double helix has solved all three of the major challenges of genetic physiology using ingenious variations on the same theme. Mirror image chemicals are used to generate mirror image chemicals, reflections used to reconstruct the original, pairs used to maintain the fidelity and fixity of information. "Monet is but an eye," Cézanne once said of his friend. But God, what an eye! DNA, by that same logic, is but a chemical, but God, what a chemical. In biology, there is an old distinction between two camps of scientists, anatomists and physiologists. Anatomists describe the nature of materials, structures, and body parts. They describe how things are. Physiologists concentrate instead on the mechanisms by which these structures and parts interact to enable the functions of living organisms. They concern themselves with how things work. This distinction also marks a seminal transition in the story of the gene. Mendel, perhaps, was the original anatomist of the gene. In capturing the movement of information across generations of peas, he had described the essential structure of the gene as an indivisible corpuscle of information. Morgan and Sturtevant extended that anatomical strand in the 1920s, demonstrating that genes were material units spread linearly along chromosomes. In the 1940s and 1950s, Avery, Watson, and Crick identified DNA as the gene molecule and described its structure as a double helix, thereby bringing the anatomical conception of the gene to its natural culmination. Between the late 1950s and the 1970s, however, it was the physiology of genes that dominated scientific inquiry. That genes could be regulated, i.e. turned on and off by particular cues, deepened the understanding of how genes function in time and space to specify the unique features of distinct cells. That genes could also be reproduced, recombined between chromosomes, and repaired by specific proteins explained how cells and organisms manage to conserve, copy, and reshuffle genetic information across generations. For human biologists, each of these discoveries came with enormous payoffs. As genetics moved from a material to a mechanistic conception of genes, from what genes are to what they do, human biologists began to perceive long-sought connections between genes, human physiology, and pathology. A disease might arise not just from an alteration in the genetic code for a protein, e.g. hemoglobin in the case of sickle cell disease, but as a consequence of gene regulation. The inability to turn the right gene on or off in the appropriate cell at the right time. Gene replication must explain how a multicellular organism emerges from a single cell, and errors in replication might elucidate how a spontaneous metabolic illness or a devastating mental disease might arise in a previously unaffected family. The similarities between genomes must explain the likeness between parents and their children, and mutations and recombination might explain their differences. Families must share not just social and cultural networks, but networks of active genes. Just as 19th century human anatomy and physiology laid the foundation for 20th century medicine, the anatomy and physiology of genes would lay the foundation for a powerful new biological science. In the decades to come, this revolutionary science would extend its domain from simple organisms to complex ones. Its conceptual vocabulary, gene regulation, recombination, mutation, DNA repair, would vault out of basic science journals into medical textbooks and then permeate wider debates in society and culture. The word race, as we shall see, cannot be understood meaningfully without first understanding recombination and mutation. The new science would seek to explain how genes build, maintain, repair, and reproduce humans, and how variations in the anatomy and physiology of genes might contribute to the observed variations in human identity, fate, health, and disease. From Genes to Genesis. In the beginning, there was simplicity. Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene. Am not I a fly like thee, or art not thou a man like me? William Blake, The Fly. While the molecular description of the gene clarified the mechanism of the transmission of heredity, it only deepened the puzzle that had preoccupied Thomas Morgan in the 1920s. For Morgan, the principal mystery of organismal biology was not the gene, but genesis. How did units of heredity enable the formation of animals and maintain the functions of organs and organisms? "Excuse my big yawn," he once told a student, "but I just came from my own lecture on genetics." A gene, Morgan had noted, was an extraordinary solution to an extraordinary problem. Sexual reproduction demands the collapse of an organism into a single cell, but then requires that single cell to expand back into an organism. The gene, Morgan realized, solves one problem, the transmission of heredity, but creates another, the development of organisms. A single cell must be capable of carrying the entire set of instructions to build an organism from scratch, hence genes. But how do genes make a whole organism grow back out of a single cell? It might seem intuitive for an embryologist to approach the problem of genesis forward, from the earliest events in the embryo to the development of a body plan of a full-fledged organism. But for necessary reasons, as we shall see, the understanding of organismal development emerged like a film run in reverse. The mechanism by which genes specify macroscopic anatomical features, limbs, organs, and structures, was the first to be deciphered. Then came the mechanism by which an organism determines where these structures are to be placed, front or back, left or right, above or below. The very earliest events in the specification of an embryo, the specification of the body axis, a front and back, and left versus right, were among the last to be understood. The reason for this reversed order might be obvious. Mutations in genes that specified macroscopic structures, such as limbs and wings, were the easiest to spot and the first to be characterized. Mutations in genes that specified the basic elements of the body plan were more difficult to identify, since the mutations sharply decreased the survival of organisms. And mutants, in the very first steps of embryogenesis, were nearly impossible to capture alive, since the embryos, with scrambled heads and tails, died instantly. In the 1950s, Ed Lewis, a fruit fly geneticist at Caltech, began to reconstruct the formation of fruit fly embryos. Like an architectural historian obsessed with only one building, Lewis had been studying the construction of fruit flies for nearly two decades. Bean-shaped and smaller than a speck of sand, the fruit fly embryo begins its life in a whir of activity. About 10 hours after fertilization of the egg, the embryo divides into three broad segments, head, thorax, and abdomen, and each segment divides into further subcompartments. Each of these embryonic segments, Lewis knew, gives rise to a congruent segment found in the adult fly. One embryonic segment becomes the second section of the thorax and grows two wings. Three of the segments grow the fly's six legs. Yet other segments sprout bristles or grow antennae. As with humans, the basic plan for the adult body is furled into an embryo. The maturation of a fly is the serial unfolding of these segments, like the stretching of a live accordion. But how does a fly embryo know to grow a leg out of the second thoracic segment or an antenna out of its head and not vice versa? Lewis studied mutants in which the organization of these segments was disrupted. The peculiar feature of the mutants, he discovered, was that the essential plan of macroscopic structures was often maintained. Only the segments switched its position or identity in the body of the fly. In one mutant, for instance, an extrathoracic segment, fully intact and nearly functional, appeared in a fly, resulting in a four-winged insect, one set of wings from the normal thoracic segment and a new set from the extrathoracic segment. It's as if the build-a-thorax gene had incorrectly been commanded in the wrong compartment and had sanguinely launched its command. In another mutant, two legs sprouted out of the antenna in a fly's head, as if the build-a-leg command had mistakenly been launched in the head. The building of organs and structures, Lewis concluded, is encoded by master regulatory effector genes that work like autonomous units or subroutines. During the normal genesis of a fly or any other organism, these effector genes kick into action at specified sites and at specified times and determine the identities of segments and organs. These master regulatory genes work by turning other genes on and off. They can be likened to circuits in a microprocessor. Mutations in the genes thus result in malformed, ectopic segments and organs. Like the Red Queen's bewildered servants in Alice in Wonderland, the genes scurry about to enact the instructions, build a thorax, make a wing, but in the wrong places or at the wrong times. If a master regulator shouts, on with an antenna, then the antenna-building subroutine is turned on and an antenna is built, even if that structure happens to be growing out of the thorax or abdomen of a fly. But who commands the commanders? Ed Lewis's discovery of master regulatory genes that control the development of segments, organs, and structures solved the problem of the final stage of embryogenesis, but it raised a seemingly infinite recursive conundrum. If the embryo is built, segment upon segment and organ by organ, by genes that command the identity of each segment and organ, then how does a segment know its own identity in the first place? How, for instance, does a wing-making master gene know to build a wing in the second thoracic segment and not, say, the first or third segment? If genetic modules are so autonomous, then why, to turn Morgan's riddle on its head, are legs not growing out of flies' heads or humans not born with thumbs emerging from our noses? To answer these questions, we need to turn the clock of embryological development backward. In 1979, 1 year after Lewis had published his paper on the genes that govern limb and wing development, two embryologists, Christiane Nusslan-Volhard and Eric Vieshaus, working in Heidelberg, began to create fruit fly mutants to capture the very first steps that govern the formation of the embryo. The mutants generated by Nusslan-Volhard and Vieshaus were even more dramatic than the ones described by Lewis. In some mutants, whole segments of the embryo disappeared, or the thorax or abdominal compartments were drastically shortened, analogous to a human fetus born with no middle or with no hind segment. The genes altered in these mutants, Nusslan-Volhard and Vieshaus reasoned, determine the basic architectural plan of the embryo. They are the mapmakers of the embryonic world. They divide the embryo into its basic subsegments. They then activate Lewis's commander genes to start building organs and body parts in some and only those compartments. An antenna on the head, a wing in the fourth segment of the thorax, and so forth. Nusslan-Volhard and Vieshaus termed these segmentation genes. But even the segmentation genes have to have their masters. How does the second segment of the fly thorax know to be a thoracic segment and not an abdominal segment? Or how does a head know not to be a tail? Every segment of an embryo can be defined on an axis that stretches from head to tail. The head functions like an internal GPS system, and the position relative to the head and the tail gives each segment a unique address in the embryo. But how does an embryo develop its basic original asymmetry, i.e. its headness versus tailness? In the late 1980s, Nusslan-Volhard and her students began to characterize a final flock of fly mutants in which asymmetrical organization of the embryo had been abrogated. These mutants, often headless or tailless, were arrested in development long before segmentation, and certainly long before the growth of structures and organs. In some, the embryonic head was malformed. In others, the front and back of the embryo could not be distinguished, resulting in strange mirror image embryos. The most notorious of the mutants was called bicoid, literally two-tailed. The mutants clearly lacked some factor, a chemical, that determines the front versus the back of the fly. In 1986, in an astonishing experiment, Nusslan-Volhard's students learned to prick a normal fly embryo with a minuscule needle, withdraw a droplet of liquid from its head, and transplant it into the headless mutants. Amazingly, the cellular surgery worked. The drop of liquid from a normal head was sufficient to force an embryo to grow a head in the position of its tail. In a volley of
path-breaking papers published between 1986 and 1990, Nusslin Volhard and her colleagues definitively identified several of the factors that provide the signal for headness and tailness in the embryo. We now know that about 8 such chemicals, mostly proteins, are made by the fly during the development of the egg and deposited asymmetrically in the egg. These maternal factors are made and placed in the egg by the mother fly. The asymmetric deposition is only possible because the egg itself is placed asymmetrically in the mother fly's body, thereby enabling her to deposit some of these maternal factors on the head end of the egg and others on the tail end. The proteins create a gradient within the egg. Like sugar diffusing out of a cube in a cup of coffee, they are present at high concentration on one end of the egg and low concentration on the other. The diffusion of a chemical through a matrix of protein can create distinct three-dimensional patterns, like a pool of syrup ribboning into oatmeal. Specific genes are activated at the high concentration end versus at the low concentration end, thereby allowing the head-tail axis to be defined, or other patterns to be formed. The process is infinitely recursive, the ultimate chicken and egg story. Flies with heads and tails make eggs with heads and tails, which make embryos with heads and tails, which grow into flies with heads and tails, and so forth ad infinitum. Or at a molecular level, proteins in the early embryo are deposited preferentially at one end by the mother. They activate and silence genes, thereby defining the embryo's axis from head to tail. These genes in turn activate mapmaker genes that make segments and split the body into its broad domains. The mapmaker genes activate and silence genes that make organs and structures. Finally, organ formation and segment identity genes activate and silence genetic subroutines that result in the creation of organs, structures, and parts. The development of the human embryo is also likely achieved through 3 similar levels of organization. As with the fly, maternal effect genes organize the early embryo into its main axes, head versus tail, front versus back, and left versus right, using chemical gradients. Next, a series of genes analogous to the segmentation genes in the fly initiates the division of the embryo into its major structural parts, brain, spinal cord, skeleton, skin, guts, and so forth. Finally, organ-building genes authorize the construction of organs, parts, and structures, limbs, fingers, eyes, kidneys, liver, and lungs. Is it sin which makes the worm a chrysalis and the chrysalis a butterfly and the butterfly dust? The German theologian Max Müller asked in 1885. A century later, biology offered an answer. It wasn't sin. It was a fusillade of genes. In Leo Leoni's classic children's book, Inch by Inch, a tiny worm is saved by a robin because it promises to measure things using its inch-long body as a metric. The worm measures the robin's tail, the toucan's beak, the flamingo's neck, and the heron's legs. The world of birds thus gets its first comparative anatomist. Geneticists, too, had learned the usefulness of small organisms to measure, compare, and understand much larger things. Mendel had shelled bushels of peas. Morgan had measured mutation rates in flies. The 700 suspenseful minutes between the birth of a fly embryo and the creation of its first segments, arguably the most intensively scrutinized block of time in the history of biology, had partly solved one of the most important problems in biology. How can genes be orchestrated to create an exquisitely complex organism out of a single cell? It took an even smaller organism, a worm of less than an inch, to solve the remaining half of the puzzle. How do cells arising in an embryo know what to become? Fly embryologists had produced a broad outline of organismal development as the serial deployment of 3 phases: axis determination, segment formation, and organ building, each governed by a cascade of genes. But to understand embryological development at the deepest level, geneticists needed to understand how genes could govern the destinies of individual cells. In the mid-1960s in Cambridge, Sidney Brenner began to hunt for an organism that could help solve the puzzle of cell fate determination. Minuscule as it was, even the fly, compound eyes, jointed legs, and elaborate behavior patterns, was much too big for Brenner. To understand how genes instruct the fates of cells,
Brenner needed an organism so small and simple that each cell arising from the embryo could be counted and followed in time and space. As a point of comparison, humans have about 37 trillion cells. A cell fate map of humans would outstrip the computing powers of the most powerful computers. Brenner became a connoisseur of tiny organisms, a god of small things. He pored through 19th-century zoology textbooks to find an animal that would satisfy his requirements. In the end, he settled on a minuscule soil-dwelling worm called Caenorhabditis elegans, C. elegans for short. Zoologists had noted that the worm was eutelic. Once it reached adulthood, every worm had a fixed number of cells. To Brenner, the constancy of that number was like a latchkey to a new cosmos. If every worm had exactly the same number of cells, then genes must be capable of carrying instructions to specify the fate of every cell in a worm's body. "We propose to identify every cell in the worm and trace lineages," he wrote to Perutz. "We shall also investigate the constancy of development and study its genetic control by looking for mutants." The counting of cells began in earnest in the early 1970s. First, Brenner convinced John White, a researcher in his lab, to map the location of every cell in the worm's nervous system. But Brenner soon broadened the scope to track the lineage of every cell in the worm's body. John Sulston, a postdoctoral researcher, was conscripted to the cell-counting effort. In 1974, Brenner and Sulston were joined by a young biologist, fresh from Harvard, named Robert Horvitz. It was exhausting, hallucination-inducing work. "Like watching a bowl of hundreds of grapes for hours at a time," Horvitz recalled, "and then mapping each grape as it changed its position in time and space." Cell by cell, a comprehensive atlas of cellular fate fell into place. Adult worms come in two different types, hermaphrodites and males. Hermaphrodites had 959 cells. Males had 1,031. By the late 1970s, the lineage of each of those 959 adult cells had been traced back to the original cell. This too was a map, although a map unlike any other in the history of science, a map of fate. The experiments on cell lineage and identity could now begin. Three features of the cellular map were striking. The first was its invariance. Each of the 959 cells in every worm arose in a precisely stereotypical manner. "You could look at the map and recapitulate the construction of an organism, cell by cell," Horvitz said. "You could say, in 12 hours this cell will divide once, and in 48 hours it will become a neuron, and 60 hours later it will move to that part of the worm's nervous system and stay there for the rest of its life. And you'd be perfectly right. The cell would do exactly that. It would move exactly there in exactly that time." What determined the identity of each cell? By the late 70s, Horvitz and Sulston had created dozens of worm mutants in which normal cell lineages were disrupted. If flies bearing legs on their heads had been strange, then these worm mutants were part of an even stranger menagerie. In some mutants, for instance, the genes that make the worm's vulva, the organ that forms the exit of the uterus, failed to function. The eggs laid by the vulvaless worm could not leave their mother's womb, and the worm was thus literally swallowed alive by its own unborn progeny, like some monster from a Teutonic myth. The genes altered in these mutants controlled the identity of an individual vulva cell. Yet other genes controlled the time that a cell divided to form two cells, its movement to a particular position in the animal, or the final shape and size that a cell would assume. "There is no history, there is only biography," Emerson once wrote. For the worm, certainly, history had collapsed into a cellular biography. Every cell knew what to be because genes told it what to become, and where and when to become. The anatomy of the worm was all genetic clockwork and nothing else. There was no chance, no mystery, no ambiguity, no fate. Cell by cell, an animal was assembled from genetic instructions. Genesis was Genesis. If the exquisite orchestration of the birth position, shape, size, and identity of every cell by genes was remarkable, then the final series of worm mutants generated an even more remarkable revelation. By the early 1980s, Horvitz and Sulston began to discover that even the death